your psyche and in your unconscious, you already have kind of a tremendous amount of material and things that you've learned, things that you've practiced, things that you yourself do. You know, it's all in there. And then the question is, of all of those things that are there, what is the most appropriate right now with this group?
Right? Exactly.
So how then, that's the thing you give to Bhagavan. This is how you do it. When you're in the meditation, you just sit there quietly, contemplating. I always do that before class. Even before class, I'll sit for, you know, with you, with all of us, sit for a few minutes. Or in meditation, before I even start the meditation, or even before I start talking about the meditation, to start the meditation, we'll all sit there quietly for some time. And then something comes inside, some idea.
Yeah.
And then you go with that idea.
Okay.
The thing is, sometimes the idea, like I've had this happen recently, actually, a couple of times where the, like the seed sprouted, you know, but the meditation that I wanted to give was too complex. And so what happens then is that I don't end up saying anything.
Yeah.
But inside, there's a meditation. But then, so it just becomes a quiet meditation. Okay. But then, that complexity sorts itself out. And then I usually talk about it at the beginning of class, you know.
Uh-huh.
Or that meditation becomes available to me the next time. You know.
In a non-complex way.
Yeah.
In a clearer way.
In a clearer way. Mm-hmm. A way that is a meditation and not like a lecture.
Yeah.
Yeah, where there's too many words to make that meditation a meditation that just doesn't gel. Mm. And so then no meditation happens.
You know? Yeah.
But that doesn't happen very often. You know, rarely actually. Mm. But it just happened twice within a few months, these last several months it happened. But then after the meditation is over, I said, well, I had a nice meditation.
So and this is what it was.
So let me share it with you. But then it becomes available.
Yeah.
Later. But that doesn't usually happen. Usually something gels inside and you just take that's just what's being pulled out in this constellation and go with that.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, that's true for your classes also. It's like with any given verse, there's any number of levels you can approach that verse. There's any number of ways you can emphasize certain parts of it. It's you're never going to do a verse or shloka in the same way.
Mm.
Every time it will be different.
Yeah.
And it's going to be different because, so if you realize it's different because of the constellation,
yeah,
that what is being drawn out of your psyche, because there's so much knowledge in there.
Yeah.
What are you going to say and what are you not going to say?
Yeah. Right?
So that shouldn't be an ego decision.
Yeah.
So you let it just come.
Yeah.
Okay. Saraswati. Saraswati, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the thing is that the classes for the meditation is from Ishwara, not from the jiva. Because you're letting it happen. And you have the knowledge. You have what you need inside. Just like a musician has within the skills. You have the skills inside, you know. So that you can do that.
Yeah.
Until you had no knowledge at all. And you're like, okay, let me do a meditation. What's a meditation? You have to know something, right?
Yeah.
So that we call it that prima materia. You know, the material is there.
Mm.
You let Ishwara make it happen. So I think that's the most valuable thing to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now you can ask a question.
Yeah. I think that's very good that you emphasize that. And then I feel confident I can just go and do it that way. Mm-hmm. And
because the other's, it's really the other is going to be ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that doesn't work. It's not deep enough. And it's not coming out of the group psyche.
Mm-hmm.
When it's coming out of the group psyche, then everybody is getting taken care of.
Mm.
The ego can't do that.
That's how Sky teaches yoga also.
Because you can't do it. The ego can't do it.
They don't know.
They don't know. Mm. Only Bhagavan knows.
So you'd never plan like a meditation and think, today I'm going to do this or that.
Mm.
Or maybe have an idea, but then...
I might have an idea, but what I need to do comes to be in the class.
Mm.
I have many ideas, right? Mm. But then when I get to the class, whether I do that idea or that idea or that idea, I decide then.
Mm.
Because it's not really a decision for me either. It's just, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah. So it's not really anything wrong in planning, as long as once you sit down, then you allow whatever comes to come.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I feel the planning is, for me, such a valuable process where I deepen my knowledge.
You know, I mean, for me, and for Swamiji, Puja Swamiji, probably for Swamiji also, I study before every class. I study the verse, I read the commentary, I think about it. It's not that I just come to class and, okay, what's part of what I'm going to do with it?
Mm-hmm.
No. Yeah. All of it, in meditations, I think about all of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you come to the class, then you have to let that kind of creativity bring all of that material up in the way that is meaningful for us as a group.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense?
Yeah.
Because I don't think that the pramana works from an ego position.
Mm.
Ego position means you're trying to use your mind to figure out what to say next, you know? That just stops that stops it.
Mm. It's a magical thing. Ungraspable thing.
It's ungraspable. Sometimes Swamiji, Puja Swamiji, after a class, he would come out and say, that was really amazing.
Yeah.
Because once he said, you know, it's like this ocean of knowledge coming through this funnel, you know, that it's a vast ocean. But the thing is that the teacher has all of this inside that can handle that ocean that is much more than what an individual jiva has available. That's why you feel like, everyone feels like, including the teacher, you're getting all these gifts, you know, like these connections and things that are just extraordinary, extraordinary clarity. The extraordinary clarity is from Ishvara. You might think that the teacher is, oh, she's so clear, you know. Or, how could she know all of that? Or how can he know all of that? How is that possible? But the teacher's also thinking that.
How is that possible?
That was so amazing.
So then I have a question. Because I feel with the preparatory steps for preparing the psyche, like inner child work and bringing in people and letting people be in their own space and, you know, laundry list and these kind of things.
Yeah.
Love to the body and all of that. That I feel, of course, like that can go in any group. Like this group will be probably like, I mean, I have no idea who's coming. But then I'm wondering, beyond that, like we talked about yesterday, when you, for example, sit with your own being, and you were saying to focus on the silence and on sound and these things. I wonder if you can expand a little bit more on that in a mixed group. Like, what can you do and what can you not do for someone who has an Shravana?
Well, I think that's something that becomes very clear for you when you're in the group, because in your mind you'll know you can't say that because they won't even know what you're talking about.
No.
So it's not going to come because it won't work.
Okay.
You know, the only things that you'll find yourself able to say are the things that they can understand. It's like if you're teaching a student Vedanta, there has to be like a sequence. Because if you say this before you say this, they won't know what you mean.
Mm.
And so the buddhi knows that.
Mm.
You know. So there's, on the other hand, there are certain things that anybody, even if they're not a Vedantin and haven't been really exposed to this knowledge, there's so many things that are useful and that can be seen and developed in many ways. Like, for instance, the inner friend, the relationship, the understanding between that kind of inner friendship and relaxation. You know, you actually can't really relax your mind and body if there's a critic inside, because the critic makes you tense. Mm-hmm. Just like it's like in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the world, that's how it is in the psyche. You know, if you're with people who love you, your body and mind naturally relax.
Mm-hmm.
If you're with people who are critical of you or don't like you, your body and mind naturally have some stress and resistance. So understanding that, then when if you understand that, then you can understand what's going on internally. Like if there's an inner critic in there, or somebody who's doesn't like you or don't like yourself, then, you know, it's not a very happy home internally. And so once that's pointed out, then you think, oh, that's true. And then you have to realize how to change that, you know. And really, then that also has to be taught. And in fact, I'm going to talk about that today in the thing, because you asked me to. And I want to talk about it. But in any case, the inner friend, what we mean by the inner friend is, like, say there's a critic or somebody talking, criticizing you, or stupid, or you're so stupid, you always do the wrong thing. Like, what if you had a father or mother like that? You never behave appropriately. Whatever, some critic in there, you know, and then in your mind, when you're little, you internalize all of that. You never do the right thing, you never behave appropriately. Whatever, you know. The inner friend is the one who, the observing, the ego, it means the deepest part of the buddhi is what becomes the inner friend. The innermost part of your buddhi is the one that can objectify, the one who can objectify everything that's going on, including the inner critic or the one that doesn't like you or the good parts of you, objectifies everything, and then becomes a friend to that. A friend means somebody who's not attacking, even the inner critic, not attacking the inner critic, understanding why that inner critic is there, and telling that little part of yourself you don't have to do that anymore. That's really a defense system that starts when you're very young. You know, because say your mom or dad is always criticizing, then in order to, this is one way of looking at it, but in order to get rid of the horrible anticipatory anxiety of being criticized, you just criticize yourself, you know. Well, we find ourselves doing that even in the world, like say you're not a very good singer like me. Instead of having to have the embarrassment of not being a very, very good, you just say, you know, I can't sing very well, but anyway, that's true. Because then you've already said it. You've already put it on the table. And so then you don't have to feel the anticipatory anxiety of, you know, having to face these shortcomings or whatever. We do this kind of thing all of the time, you know. But it's to quench this anxiety, you know. And so when you're little, just to bring it back, when you're little, that's a defense system. We use that defense system in kind of, in a sense, a more mature way now, but it's still it is a defense system, you know, that kind of means that you don't have to face what you're afraid of facing in the world. So the psyche takes care of you when you're 2, 3 years old, 4 years old. Mm. It'll just do the, be critical. So now we don't have to wait for that. You know, we don't have to worry about that now. I'm already badgering myself and I can handle it. Otherwise you're waiting, you know. My dad was a kind of a very scary man. He wasn't that bad, but for little children he was. And when it would get time to for him to come home, we'd all be waiting, you know, afraid what's going to happen when he walks in the door, mm-hmm. you know. So you have to do something to kind of handle that. So the psyche is going to have all kinds of defense systems, you know. Our defense system was to run into our rooms or run outside of the place so he wouldn't be around. But what I'm saying is you have to do something because you're scared, you know. And so you're scared of that criticism or scared of the anger or whatever. And so your psyche is many, we have many different defense systems, but that coming in and doing it to yourself is one that happens all the time, especially in childhood. And then the thing is that defense system just keeps operating. Okay, well that works. So now here you are at like 40 years old or 50 years old or 80 years old. The same defense system is coming into operation until you understand it. You recognize it. And then you can come in, like with the inner friend, come in with dialogue and relieve the psyche of that burden. Because it's just, it's trying to protect you. Yeah, it's like, this is my job, you know? But it's the job that started when you were like 2 or 3 years old. Yeah, it's just like an automatic response. So a lot of the self-talk that goes on in your psyche is automatic response from childhood. You don't even... Because it comes from childhood, you don't even notice it. You know? It's just like the air. But if we ask, listen to how you talk to yourself, then you start listening. Oh, often. Because most people have a lot of inner critic, a lot of harshness. And you don't even know it. You take it for granted. Yeah. But what about when you become aware of it? Then you can actually easily change it. By that inner dialogue, and then you find, I mean, I remember when this happened, when I first realized this, Swamiji just said something, it's just a blessing, I got it, because something had just passed through in the class, I don't even think he was not focusing on it really, but it had to do with that kind of inner friend of how we are inside, how we treat ourselves, I just saw it. And then I went to my room and I actually kind of remembered it. And then I started doing that. And my whole psyche was so happy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that there was somebody inside that really cared about me. And it's a huge thing. I know so many of my clients, I teach it to all my clients, I teach it to all my students at CIS. And it's major. It's a major easy fix. And, you know, it's very, very powerful. So many students and so many clients will say, like when we're terminating in things, that that's one of the most important things that has happened for them, that made a beautiful home, inner home, you know, and learning the inner child work. You don't have to have anything to do with Vedanta. But the thing is that we need to know that ourselves, because it takes care of us on a psychological level that gives us the kind of shanti that we need. Mm. You know, and it's a psychological fix. Vedanta so deeply fixes the fundamental problem of self-ignorance and not even knowing myself or even that there is a self, really, you know. And so that creates a beautiful space and safety, the safety of my own being, the beauty of my own being. But then, just like you can have a broken leg, you know, a broken arm or whatever, you can have wounds in your psyche. And so there's ways for us on a relative level to go in and take care of those things. We need to know it. That's part of, we can include that in karma yoga, since it's, you know, it's part of the tools that we need in order to bring our psyche back to a place of real shanti. Mm-hmm. So that inner friend, inner child work, mm-hmm. having a real conversation with Bhagawan instead of, you know, I lay me down to sleep. Mm-hmm. Or God bless mommy and daddy and everybody and everybody and everybody. But not me, of course, because I'm humble and I don't want to take your time. All of this kind of stuff, you know. So you have to teach all of that and give them have a real relationship with Bhagawan, where you really say everything that's on your mind, what's bothering you, you know. So that, like you would with your people that you love, you say, tell everything, and you're honest. The most honest you should be is with Bhagawan. Mm. And then also, you may not like Bhagawan. It might be a God image that you don't like at all. Mm. And so then you have to have that conversation. I don't like you. What I think you are, I don't like. Because of blah, 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 blah. I hope it's different than that. That's why I'm telling you about it. Just want you to know how I feel. You know? So positive and negative. So that you open up to one being you should not be afraid of. Is Bhagawan. So that's also, you know, whatever their God image is, what is their relationship with God? You know, is it? So can you talk about that? Like say you have your partner. There's some things about your partner you really don't like. You never talk about that. Or some ways where you're becoming totally, you know, no more communication because you've shut down. You don't want to have that with Isha. You don't want to have that with any human being. You really don't want to have it with Bhagawan. You have to be able to say everything. And then that's something that holds the buddhi. The buddhi holds the little ones, right? Mm-hmm. As the mother, father of the little ones inside. But then the buddhi itself has to be held. So the buddhi, as you mature in your knowledge, the buddhi is held by the Atma and by Yeshua. It's the same, but when you're focusing on the Atma, you're just focusing on your own being. When you're focusing on Ishvara, you're giving this body, mind, sense organs to Bhagawan and let him take care of it. You have some big difficulty in the world, in your mind, you don't have no idea what to do. Let's see what Bhagawan does. I did that all the time, let's see what Bhagawan does. I don't know. I have no idea how this is going to unfold or what's going to happen. Let's see what Bhagawan does. Because as you understand Bhagawan, I mean, that's the whole infinite mind, infinite knowledge. So let's see Bhagawan's plan, you know, see how things unfold. And you get used to more and more living in the present and being present to the unfoldment of your life rather than always trying to second guess it. Because you can't really second guess it, you know. It creates a lot of stress. But you can be present to what your responsibilities are now, you know. So these are things that are logical, can be taught, can be practiced in forms and meditation. Mm-hmm. And then another thing is that whether you have self-knowledge or not, or any Ishwara or not, still experientially in your buddhi, in the psyche, there is a ground of being that is changeless. Mm. Whatever you want to call it, if you want to call it the deep mind, or you want to call it as, because you don't have any knowledge one way or the other, if you want to call it just the observing ego, or whatever you call it, Nevertheless, it is there. There is in yourself that being which is a sanctuary, and that's available to you. It's available to all beings. You can talk about it differently, but it's there. You know, and so when you're doing a guided meditation, that see or seen, you know, to help, that type of see or seen is one way to kind of help get to that beautiful space that's holding you. You don't have to take it all into a lot of Vedanta. You're just getting a person to recognize that beautiful space that is ever present no matter what you're going through. So to find a deeper place in yourself. You can talk about it like that.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about it, describing something that you want them to have. And they're not Vedantins or whatever, so they're not ready to kind of go all the way with that. But nevertheless, there is that space, holding space, beautiful holding space in yourself that you have access to. You don't have to say any more than that. When they're ready, if they want to learn, then you can take them so far. But all of these things on a relative level are helpful.
Because that alone is huge.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And they can have it. I give it to my clients. I'm not teaching them Vedanta. I'm not giving them a lecture. Not at all.
Just a discovery.
That's a discovery. That's something that's there. And also, you know, if you're a therapist or if I'm teaching spiritual counseling at school, and it's not like I do teach non-dual spiritual counseling. But even then I have to be careful because people have lots of understandings of non-dual. They come from a lot of different traditions. So I try to teach these things in a way that they can translate into their own kind of religion or spirituality. They can see it, translate it, use it. You know, when I'm teaching Advaita Vedanta, the psychology of Advaita Vedanta, then I don't need to bring in or think about the different types of Bauda, different types of Buddhism or yoga or anything like that, because the class is Advaita Vedanta. But if it's not, then I have to teach it in a way that they can take these as tools and understand it within their own spiritual tradition. And that's not hard, really. It's not hard to do. Because it's all based upon pointing them to an experience that is already there. And then they can do what they want with it, but you are showing them something useful that is there for them to recognize. See what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't have to talk about this non-dual self or self-involved in all beings, depending on the class. Of course, in our classes, you know, these classes are the pramana. They are the Advaita Vedanta. And so that's, we can just teach you all of that. But, you know, if you're in school or something, unless it's a Vedanta class, you don't have that. It's not appropriate. But you don't have to teach it. There's so many things you can do. Yeah, so in meditation, it's like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know when we, or maybe I stay on the same track. You know when, like you often say, like you said now also, that it's an experience that they already have. Like you often use the word experience when you talk about myself. And
yes, but I always circle around self-evident versus.
Yeah, yeah, you point out the difference. It's not as objectified, something that's objectified and all of that.
I'll say something like the me experience or the self experience.
Yeah.
And then I'll always talk about it being self-evident. The reason I do that, it's because I've come across in the West, well, because in California especially, there's so many Buddhists. They think there is no self-experience. There's only experience of everything else. but there is no me. You know, like say in the subject-object relationship, the only thing that is known is the object.
That's kind of illogical.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Here I am not.
Here I am not, yeah. I am not here. We're actually in this verse today in the Dakshinamurti, we're going to be talking about this, you know. Mm-hmm. What we call the Kshanika Vijnana Vadins, who take the sense of self to be an illusion, illusory. I'll talk about it in class. And then the Shunya Vadins, who think that there's no self. But I mean, I'll explain all that. So because there's such a negation of self, there's no idea of recognizing the nature of the subject, because there is no subject to recognize. Mm. See what I mean?
Yeah, then they're really missing out.
Yeah, they're really missing out. Mm. But your self is present. It's self-evident. It's not a non-experience. It's not a void.
Yeah.
That it is its own being, its own self-evident experience. Mm. So using its word experience is tricky, because when we think of experience comes into being, goes out of being, so all of these experiences that are coming our way. But we don't think of my own nature as being present, experientially present, as opposed to unknown, mm-hmm. experientially unknown, no experience, you know.
Yeah.
You have to be careful.
Because like when I have a subject-object experience, then that takes place in the mind, right? Can you say that?
The experience, that anything that's objectified,
yeah,
takes place in the mind.
Yeah.
Any objectifiable experience takes place in the mind. So say you have a thought, then what is the content of that thought in terms of nama rupa, name and form? Remember that nama rupa includes even emotions, because anything that can be differentiated from something else has its own form, because it's differentiated by the other thing. So even that's true even for emotions or memories or anything. Mm. There's nama rupa there because it can be differentiated from something else. Space is nama rupa, even though it's formless. It's differentiated from the other four elements. Mm-hmm. Space is not water, it's not earth. And so because of, we use nama rupa in that way, anything that can exist within time and space differentiated from another thing, that's nama rupa, mm-hmm. objectifiable. So it's anything that is objectifiable requires the mind, because mm-hmm. it's mitya. Mm-hmm. It's not self-evident. See, this is the important thing. We're having class up here, then.
Yeah.
And anyway, anything that's objectifiable, right, is not self-evident. Otherwise, it would be self-shining. Mm-hmm. Nobody has to objectify it. You don't need to bring in a pramana. You don't need to bring in some means of knowledge in order for it to be known. Mm-hmm. If there's only one thing like that, and that's the Atma. So if the Atma... And from the Atman, there is no subject-object relationship, because there's no duality. There's just simply me. Mm. So anything objectifiable requires a pramana, and pramana requires a mind, except for Ishwara. Because Ishwara, the whole sattva, everything is in his mind. Mm. So he doesn't require a mind directed. You know what I mean? Mm. So for us, every experience that's not self-evident requires a mind, because the experience is not self-evident. The mind itself is not self-evident.
And I know I asked this the other day, but I don't remember. Can we say the mind is throughout the body?
The sukshma, look at it like this, the sukshma sharira is throughout the body, right?
Yeah.
But on the other way of looking at this, so that's for sure, you know?
Yeah.
The sense of touch is throughout the body.
Yeah.
Right? In fact, the sense of touch in terms of the five sense organs is the major problem. Mm. Because my sense of touch pervades the body, but it doesn't pervade the space. So I have the sense of me is identified with this body, not with the universe, because the sense of touch doesn't extend to the universe, you know. So the sense of touch, though, gives the vritti experience to the mind. Right? Gives the experience to the mind.
Yeah.
However, what in science, in psychology, we're finding more and more is that the unconscious psyche is stored in the body. That's why with things like Rolfing and whatever these other ones I'm trying to think of. There's so many different... That's what I was thinking of, cranial psyche. There's so many different methodologies now that are actually working the body and working the body in various ways. A lot of unconscious material is released. So the psyche itself is stored in the body. You know? The psyche belongs to the... The psyche belongs to the sukshma sharira. Is it subtle?
Yeah.
But how far does it pervade through the body, and how does that work?
Yeah.
Right, so I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But we know, we find experientially that it is.
It makes sense that it would be throughout.
Throughout. Yeah.
That's how I'm going to look at it.
Yeah.
But then when we talk about the self experience, or the which is not an objectifiable experience, which is self-evident, then I feel like even though that's always emphasized, these things, it feels like I'm going to have to make a very, very consciously decide to not think about it in the same way as other experiences, because it kind of slips in there. And then the word experience, then but how does that experience take place?
That's the problem with the word experience, because when we use the word, but of course, there's a problem with every word in Vedanta.
Yeah.
Every single word has to be unfolded in the duality pulled off of it. Right?
Mm.
But it's not an experience in the sense of an experience that comes and goes. It's your self-evident nature.
Mm.
And because it's self-evident, that means the experience is there. But not an objectified experience, it's just the nature of consciousness itself is an experience.
Mm.
That's what we mean by self-evident. But it's different because it's not an objectifiable experience, it's not an experience that comes and goes.
Mm.
It's just the self-evident nature of your being, this swaprakasha, swatasiddha, swaprakasha. Prakasha means light, you know? So swaprakasha, it means it is its own light, it's its own luminosity. It doesn't require another light to come and light it up, you know, like another consciousness to come and illumine it.
Like if I think of it as my self-experience equals isness,
being.
Then it...
Self-evident being.
Self-evident. Is it wrong to say isness?
No, self-evident isness.
Yeah. Then, yes.
Then it's good for you.
Yeah, then it works.
Yeah, see, in Vedanta, that's another thing, is that for each one of us, some words work and others don't.
Mm.
And so that's why the teacher has to say things in different ways.
Mm.
And also, what happens in satsang like this, we discover, saying it that way doesn't work. Mm. Because I have a couple of students who almost... What I say hardly ever works. But they explain it, you know, and then I say, I see why that word's not working for you, you know. It's really, really interesting. And then I say, that doesn't work, and then I understand why it doesn't work, and then I have to go around and explain that in a different way. Oh, that's what you mean. Do we have our breakfast?
Yeah. Thank you.
Maybe we can continue.